Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, the great Sean Penn is going to join us for a nice, long, revealing interview, and he gets into a lot of varied subjects here. So that's coming in a second. First, I'll tell you about Dodge. Summer. Best time to join the Brotherhood of Muscle. Dodge Power Dollars. You get 10 bucks off based on the total horsepower of your new Dodge. Every 2020 Challenger, Durango, Charger. Muscle, baby. American muscle. That thing got a hammy? Hell yes. Enjoy the sweet sounds of the Dodge Charger SRT Scat Packs, 485 horsepower, and get, you're doing the math, $4,850 off. You get it? 10 bucks for every horsepower, one horsepower. And the summer power dollars are back on the Dodge Durango performance-driven SUV. Just because you're driving an SUV doesn't mean you're boring, man. Make summer trips a breeze. Fit everyone in with the Durango 7-passenger seating capacity. Get more power. Get more off. It's simple. Hurry to your local Dodge dealer now. Take advantage of the Dodge Power Dollars.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
Hey, Corolla fans, Mike Dawson here. I got some good news and some bad news. Bad news first, we're sold out of this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Good news is you'll still be able to get all the incredible products from beerbong.com and Beard Bro after this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Head to beerbong.com and get your 6-foot beer bong and a gold mine of other beer-related products. Believe us, you will get drunk and social distance if you need to. For all of you bearded men out there, remember to head to thebeardbro.com for all your facial hair needs. A big thank you to both Beard Bro and beerbong.com for participating in this month's nut. We'll see you soon for another shipment of Adam's Monthly Nut.
One thanks, Sean Penn, for joining us on the program. We're going to talk a lot about everything, but we'll first start with CORE, and we'll tell you exactly what that is. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Good to be here.
And thanks. I guess how this came about is you tweeted out something nice about the documentary I made on Willie T. Ribbs called Uppity, and you sent a nice tweet out. So thanks.
Yeah. Well, thanks for making it. It's a fantastic documentary and a great incredibly current story, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's weird. We started on that doc probably 3 years ago, so it's crazy how it works, right? I mean, timing is everything, I guess.
Well, I think when you make things you believe in, they find a way of paying off in timing one way or the other.
Well, you know, as I was reading about you today, and I'll bring this full circle, CORE, which is an acronym for Community Organized Relief Effort, which is Sean's organization, and it operates in a lot of different capacities. Right now, they're focused on COVID-19 testing, and they got sites all over the United States, and they've administered over 600,000 tests, by the way, so far. But it started with earthquakes and Haiti relief. But as I was reading about that, I was reading about you, and I thought, well, who's another actor who's done a lot of philanthropic work? And Paul Newman. And the reason Uppity, the doc, is made is when I made a doc about Paul Newman's racing life, that's when I discovered Willie T. Ribbs. So now we've come full circle.
And Newman was an extraordinary fellow, and I wasn't surprised when I saw the documentary to see that he, you know, played a role in championing Willie.
Well, it kind of makes you, you know, when you really think about it, we all get caught up with money and fame and many other things. But your legacy is kind of really what you did for other people, like if you really think about it. And I don't know, is that something that runs through your mind?
Well, I'd like if my last moment comes not too abruptly and I have a moment to think back, that I think back without an entire suitcase full of shame. Yeah. You know, I do feel that it's also sort of beholden upon everybody to on their own terms, get more involved with what's happening, get more aware of how things happen, who's accountable for what happens, and throw in with civic duty.
What percentage of your time is spent with the civic duty and core specifically versus the artistic endeavors, writing, directing, acting, that kind of stuff?
You know, I haven't done the math on this, but it's funny sometimes when I talk about the core aspect of my life, because it's only been that part of it. It's really only been going on 11 years, I guess. And I am sure that I've put in twice the hours in 11 years on that work, on disaster relief and development, than I have all the hours on movie sets. It's an extremely demanding job, in part because of the nature of the work that the organization does and that I have had my hand in. But it's also the part of it that is raising money, because while, you know, the assumption is that if you work in movies, you're rolling in cash, you spend out on this stuff fast and frequently to keep things going, to give it a stimulus and so on, and to raise money from the outside, especially in areas of prevention, which is what we're really hoping to achieve with the COVID-19 testing as it relates to what may happen in the fall. Prevention is let's say, the least sexy of disaster relief work, and it's the thing probably most certainly most important.
The corresponse.org is the website, and that's where you can go and where you should go to volunteer or make a donation or get involved and or at least get educated in it. I was on the website today. It's all there at corresponse.org. I don't know you very well. I think I met you over at Seth MacFarlane's house some years ago at a Christmas party. But I did know Chris fairly well, your brother. And I do know Michael, your other brother, fairly well, mainly because I know Amy Mann fairly well and because she has a great interest in boxing. And I used to be a boxing trainer, so I used to I've held the focus pads with her a few times, so we'll talk pugilism in a second. First, I was interviewing Rob Lowe for this show a few weeks ago, and I know you guys all kind of grew up in the same area. And I told him, he brought up your brother Chris, and I said, let me tell you a story about Chris. And he said, that's about the most Chris Penn story I've ever heard in my life. And it was, he did Loveline, my syndicated radio show, a million years ago. It was like a Wednesday night, Culver City, 1998. Place was broken down and nothing going on. And when we're finished doing the show, we finished at midnight. And I was like heading home and he's like, hey, let's get a drink. And I said, I don't know. It's Culver City. It's midnight. It's Wednesday. There's nothing going on. He said, I know a cop bar. Come with me. I said, okay. And I followed him to a shithole dive of a cop bar in Culver City, and then he just walked in and everyone knew him, and we sat there and drank beers on a Wednesday night. And I thought that sounded like a very on point Chris Penn story. Was that the kind of guy he was?
You know, he would ask one to rally for sure. Would know where to go to rally. Tying it into the pugilism part, my favorite thing, I remember when Conan O'Brien first started doing his show, and Christopher had done Chris was a fighter. He was a mixed martial artist and a boxer, and he was quite a bit more handy than most actors who were boxers, and strong, naturally strong, like a bull. A short right hand would, you know, send your last name into Tuesday, and did on an occasion with me. He way outskilled and outweighed me. And he was on Conan's show, and Conan said this to him, said, I understand, you know, for, you know, a lot of actors claim to be boxers and, you know, want to be tough guys and all of that. He says, but I understand you're really pretty good with your hands. And he says, you know, I do okay. And he says, well, would you fight Mickey Rourke? He says, anytime, anywhere. And then he says, would you fight Jean-Claude Van Damme? He says, anytime, anywhere. And then he says, okay, next week on this show, a cage fight, Sean and Chris Penn against Jean-Claude Van Damme and Mickey Rourke. And Christopher's response was, we don't need Sean.
Well, I do miss that guy. I'm sure not as much as you, but I don't know. I just always, I loved him on screen, but I liked him off screen too. I don't know. I felt like he just had a presence that just sort of carried, sort of transcended that.
Sweetheart.
Yeah. What's that?
Gentle giant sweetheart guy.
Yeah. There's just something about a sort of zeal and a zest and a whatever for life that was kind of infectious. And then, I don't know. And then Michael, I like a lot too, but he seems incredibly different than Chris. And I was trying to figure out how you guys got so far apart. I don't mean spiritually. I just mean how you come from the same two biological parents, right? How did this happen?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you had Christopher who became quite the extrovert, Michael, who's quite by nature internal, and me who kind of, I'll tread between the two at various stages of life. There was a big joke about this that my mother and dad used to laugh a lot about because it didn't seem possible we were from the same two. So it was kind of like, hey, Ma, you know, who's the dad? But we each knew very well that our dad was our dad. And so there's no explaining it. What am I trying to tell? I'm not a DNA scientist, but I don't know any three more different brothers.
I was reading about your dad as I was preparing to speak to you, and I saw a little thing about him flying B-24s in World War II, but there wasn't much on it on his wiki page, so I sort of took a deeper dive into it. I'm a little bit of a World War II buff, and I like the planes of World War II, and I was thinking about, I always think about what those guys had to do going out on those missions and those planes, and I guess your dad was a rear tail gunner and bombardier, I guess, sight guy. And I was surprised at how many missions that guy went out on. So can you brag? And I read the expose you talked about with your dad and being blacklisted, and I thought that was very interesting stuff. So we can get into that. But brag a little about your dad. I was pretty blown away by that guy.
Yeah, so let me see here. You see that plane right there? That was a Liberator. That's his flight crew right there. They were doing low altitude night raids over Germany, flying out based out of London, and the nature of those flights were, I think, a 6-7 mission life expectancy. So from that point forward, it was voluntary, and I think their unit broke the record at 37 voluntary missions. Got shot down twice. Got the aircraft back over Allied lines before they had to bail it. What you said, you know, what that must have been to be on these cranky old engines, flying at night, getting hit with artillery, and then jumping out with the parachutes of the day, with probably only, jumping off a 5-foot ledge in training to learn how to do it. It says something coming out, you know, Depression era kid, all of that stuff, and all of those guys were. And it does say something about, you know, our resolve, be it, you know, God forbid, in military service that is like that, wars like most wars, or in any way, what happens, how much strength is involved when people have grown up as a generation in society with so much less comfort than so many do today. It's a lesson because I can't quite imagine what that must have been.
Well, everybody should, when you go to one of those, you should go to one of those old aero museums, airplane museums. And if you can, as I've done it a few times, crawl up the ladder and climb into the belly of one of those planes. First things first, you can't imagine how claustrophobic it was in there. Secondly, zero creature comforts, no insulation, no padding, no nothing, just sheet metal around a fuselage. Like whatever temperature was outside, that's the temperature it was inside. If any bullets or shrapnel would just go right through it like a tin can. Like people have no idea how Spartan it was inside of those planes. And the notion of flying in that plane just in and of itself would be scary. Now, the notion of being shot at with flak while on that plane, I couldn't imagine. But anyone who survived that must have had, pardon the pun, a kind of a grounding that he must have been unflappable.
He was. It's interesting that, you know, I talked to him a little bit about what we would consider today a PTSD and so on. And he went through, as they, I'm sure they all did, he went through a kind of period of years with dreams, bad dreams. But there was something in the way society embraced that era soldier that made such an incredible difference. It's a real, again, a lesson for us today, because, you know, these guys are made of everything that they were. These young guys that do this and women that do this now. But we do know that in modern wars, there's not the support when they return. There's not been policy that aligned with society's, with the general public's ultimate belief in what was happening. That war was unique in that sense, and I think that people did unite on it, and maintained that feeling of being united on it. And still do today, where so many others don't. And it's there's got to be a way we can separate our sense of the policy from the soldiers who fight the wars and take care of them better.
So I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and I'm from the San Fernando Valley. I don't know that many people who grew up out here, but I think your dad, as I was trying to read the story, did he settle in the San Fernando Valley and then you guys moved out to the west side, or were you always on the west side? How did the chronology of that work?
Yeah, his father came out here to make some money to bring the family out here from Lawrence, Massachusetts. And then he followed with his mother about 2 years later when the San Fernando Valley was nothing but orange groves. And they settled in what is now City Terrace, East LA. Mm-hmm. That's where they lived until into my childhood, where my grandparents lived. And then when he came back, once the family got started, Michael was born in New York, and so it was a little back and forth stuff. I was born out here, as was Christopher, and they settled in the Valley, North Hollywood, Burbank, Sherman Oaks, Woodland Hills, and my mother kept trying to move it further towards the beach. But my dad was directing in television at the time, and he wasn't looking forward to the commute from the more rural, what was then the more rural and the more working class end of Malibu, which is where I am right now, but it's not what it was. It's about 58% more structures out here, and it's a commuter zone now, typically, because LA expanded so much. But at that time, this was really rural, and my mother prevailed, and he was pretty fond of her, so she was able to prevail with a couple extra smiles. And that's when we moved out to the beach, 1970. I was 10.
Yeah, I grew up in North Hollywood and North Hollywood, Burbank, Valley Village and all that stuff. So my entire family's from there. Sadly, we never got to the beach. We just stayed in North Hollywood. But yeah, people don't realize how rural Malibu was, and how as all the stuff I got into with Rob Lowe is what it was, kind of a hippie zone, and school teachers lived in regular houses and there was no school there. You guys all had to make the commute to Santa Monica, which is, 15 miles up PCH, or 10 miles or whatever it is. Did you grow up in the sort of Point Doom area like Rob? Rob grew up out there and said a lot of you guys, I wrote down some of it. I mean, you're older than some of these guys, but you all ended up sort of in the same business and you all kind of come from the same place. So I don't know if you knew the Charlie Sheens and the Robert Downey Juniors and the Rob Lowes and Holly Robinson, people like that.
Yeah, I knew Charlie because Emilio and I had become friendly. I think principally through Charlie's friendship with Christopher, because the Charlie and Christopher were the same age, and Emilio was somewhere between the ages. He's a couple of years younger than I am. Charlie and Christopher 5 years younger than I am. So I knew some of those guys. I may have met Rob at that time. I think I'd remember because we knew who he was because he was already an actor as a kid and working in television and all. So you kind of knew who the kid working actor was that lived in town. I did meet him later once we were all working in movies, but I wasn't sure if I had spent time and knew him. I did. We made a lot of Super 8 movies and that sort of thing. Just this little crew with Charlie and Chris and Emilio. So it may have been that I met him. But I was 5 years older than most of that crew. And so I didn't, and a lot of them, as it turned out, weren't that interested in surfing. And I was spending most of my time in the water at that age. So I wasn't real close with that group, at then.
Were you, how were you as a student?
I was terrible.
Yeah, makes sense. I was speaking of surfing. So I remember my first thoughts about you is I went and saw Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And here's what a Valley dude I am. I saw it at the Glendale Galleria the Sherman Oaks Galleria. I saw it where they filmed the movie. The movie theater that the guy worked at in the movie, that's the theater I saw it in. So that's how ground zero I was for the Valley. That's where we would go to watch movies. That was like the first megaplex there was on like the third floor of the Sherman Oaks Galleria. So I went and saw that movie. I love that movie, and I thought your performance was great in it. But I was pretty naive. I just thought that's who you are. And then I went to the movies, and I saw the second movie with you starring in it that came after that, which was Bad Boys, which was a completely and utterly different role. You know, I'm pretty young and kind of naive. And I was like, how did that guy become that guy in that role? And that's when I thought, oh, this guy's interesting because he just did that guy. And now he's doing this guy. And everyone knows Spicoli. But if you watch Bad Boys, it's not only is it a good movie, it's really dark. And Sean's character's, I don't know, the exact opposite of Spicoli. Like, did you want to do that right after Fast Times to kind of show people your range, or did it just fall out that way?
Well, I can say, you know, part of this is, you know, I didn't have the pick of the litter necessarily on all kinds of parts. It depended on if a director decided to be interested in me. I'd been in, like you say, Fast Times. I'd had a supporting part in this movie, Taps, but I don't know the order when these things came out. But the it was an era where there were where what excited me to be an actor. Really, I was interested. It's the cliche in directing movies, but you don't as a 19-year-old or 17 getting out of high school think you're going to get somebody to give you millions of dollars to support a dream you've got and have to be the adult in the room. So then out of that interest in getting close to film, I started focusing as an actor and working in theater. And at that time, what then became exciting in a way I hadn't considered what actors do was if you take a look at who was working at that time, from Robert De Niro to Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino. And these guys, and I think Bob in particular, that was what was exciting, was that there was something brand new every time and committed and razor committed. And that was kind of like this whole, you know, whether it's working in film or anything else I do feels like the same job because it's all about getting up in the morning and feeling like I got a purpose that I really can focus on. And those guys just excited the shit out of you. You couldn't reach for being Jack Nicholson unless you were born in the mold that was made once and broken once. But you could you could focus on, it was tangible to not, there was no way to copy somebody because you weren't going to play the roles they were going to play. And that was a good immunity to have. But you could sure be inspired by what they reached for and what they committed to that was totally varied. And I got really lucky in terms of some of the things that I got to do at that time relative to my age with my peers. And I think were it not for a part like Fast Times, that A, because of the movie and the nature and the humor of it all, got enough attention that anything I might have done that was different was going to get some heat behind me. Anything that didn't carry that. And I look at it now and I kind of go, how the hell did that happen? And I know the answer. It had to do with some people who believed in me a lot. But at the time, it was all that I just figured, this is pretty cool. I'm getting to do different things. And then it becomes the nature of what you're pursuing.
It just jumped into my head. One of the lines that always made me laugh super hard in Fast Times is when you walked into, I don't know, Mr. Hand's class, and you just sort of out of the side of your mouth went, hey, I know that dude. And then you just kept walking. And I thought it was so funny because I thought that was so perfect for your character, that your character would do that if he walked into a class, even though it had nothing to do with the scene. And I was just sitting around today and I thought, did Sean say that, or was that in the script, or do you remember?
You know, I don't remember. I was given a lot of freedom to improvise, but it was off of a part that Cameron Crowe had written very well. So there were, if not that one, there were several trigger moments that were just like that, that were in the script. And that may have been one of them. I don't want to claim credit to something like that because it's a long time ago, Adam. There was a guy circling back to Point Doom in that era. You know, virtually the elementary school had a hitching post and all the girls rode horses. And we said Point Doom, where the girls ride bareback and the boys are lonely. And there was actually a hitching post. Some of the girls would ride to school, and it was that kind of environment. And there was in this environment one guy, several, but one guy in particular, and that's the other writer of that character, is the guy who lived around here, who I used to see around and out in the water at that time, who may well have been, it may also have been something I witnessed, where that guy came into a class and said that. There was the dominant writer was Cameron Crowe. I played around with Cameron's stuff here and there, and then there were things that I pulled out a front row seat.
Yeah, because you were that guy. I mean, you were the SoCal surfer. Guys started in the Valley. I mean, the whole thing, it took place in the San Fernando Valley. And, you know, actually, I played football at North Hollywood High in 81. I graduated in 82. And when they were showing the football stuff, the Wolves, that was Van Nuys High. Those guys, when they were showing the sidelines and the cheerleaders, that was from the season I played. I saw guys who were on my All Valley team that were on the sideline, like playing. Like that was a real San Fernando Valley movie. And so for you, you started in the San Fernando Valley, ended up being a surfer on the other side of the hill. So Spicoli must have been just tailor-made for you, but it still didn't mean you got the spot or got the part. Was that difficult? Did you know anybody? Was that just like go out and audition? Like how'd that come about?
I remember I do, in fact, right just now before I got on, I've always used woodwork as therapy, and I had done some carpentry when I was a kid, and I was in the beginning of getting movies and working in the theater I'd been doing, and then I was at the beginning of getting movies. I'd done Taps, and I had, you know, the grand fortune of about $15,000 in the bank, which was something else. And I remember I kept my tools and such out in my parents' garage here in Point Doom. And I was in that garage and they had one of those, one of those phones you'd put in the charging thing and you could do it freehand.
Right.
And I remember it rang and the agent I'd signed up with, Paula Wagner at Creative Artists, she called and said, you know, there's this thing. I know you're not looking necessarily to do comedies, which wasn't true, but I probably scowled a lot and people thought I didn't want to do comedies. But this is, she's a very sensitive director and this, since a female director. And I said, send it. And I read it and I thought, gosh, I know this part. I know this guy and I want to do it really badly. And I went, I got an audition and I got into the room. There were several other people there, not just for the part I was playing, but for all those parts that we see in that movie. And some of the people in the room, including Nick Cage, did end up in the movie that day. And there were people in that room every day for months while they were casting. But I went in and I am a terrible auditioner. I get very self-conscious if I don't have the excuse of being paid to do my job and somebody saying action and cut the film running through the camera or the chronology, right, what happens. And so I went in the room and I told them that I knew the part. I think I told them I was a terrible auditioner. And then they say, yeah, read the scene. And I read the scene and I showed them, in fact, that I was a terrible auditioner. And that was that. I walked out. And then something happened in that room. What I know and who I know was involved for sure, because there were about four or five people in that room, Cameron, Amy Heckerling, Art Linson, Don Phillips, casting director. And Don came running after me in the parking lot. And this is a guy this guy, Don Phillips, was one of these casting directors that I don't know how many are around anymore, but this guy loved actors first. Hmm. And he had a gut thing. He found so many talented people from Nick Cage, Matthew McConaughey, Renee Zellweger. I mean, this guy was a champion of a lot of people. And I was a beneficiary of his eye, let's say, and he came running after me in the parking lot and said, basically, get your ass back in there and do it again. I just convinced those people to let you do it again. And I went in there and I gave it a little bit more. And I guess with some conniving, Don said, let's go for it. Then bit by bit, I put the pieces of the part together and we did it. But it was one of these ones that shouldn't have happened. It was a flat, terrible.
Yeah, I don't know how many times anyone's been walking out to the parking lot after an audition and had someone run up, gather them, and tell them to do it again. Like, it's one thing to run up and get the person and go, my God, you're perfect, don't go anywhere. But it's another thing to grab the person and go, that stunk, but I know there's more in the tank, so turn around and try it again.
Yeah.
That's a great story. And I was thinking about the movie that you did with your brother Chris at Close Range, and I thought, oh, I love that movie. I kind of forgot there's a few movies out there, as I've said, like Bad Boys, great movie, At Close Range with Christopher Walken, based on a true story, and then you acting with your brother must have been interesting. But that was a great movie as well. And if you look on Rotten Tomatoes, and I did, those movies are in like high 80s when it comes to the critics. Like, they're really well received as well. I think it may be your third highest rated movie.
Yeah, I'm so proud of that movie. And Jamie Foley did a great job directing it. Working with Chris Walken was a dream, as well as with Chris Penn. And my mother played our grandmother in the thing, so it was a family affair.
I did not know that. So for you, you said, people didn't look at you as a comedic actor, but like, I just saw you on Curb Your Enthusiasm a few months ago, and it was really funny. And I think sometimes we think that guys that are serious or play the heavy or scowl, as you said, can't handle the funny. But evidently, you always could. Is there some... do you want to do more comedy roles?
You know, I've never been somebody who could invest in what you'd call kind of pure careerism. Of course, I have ambitions of my own, and there are things that I'll weigh strategically here and there in terms of whether it's financially what my need is at that time, or in terms of being able opportunities to work with certain directors. But I've never been one to kind of design anything other than I want to do something that feels connected to a story as much as I get an opportunity to, like, where the whole thing, a body of work, means has connections, and to have parts that I could sink my teeth into. So in terms of kind of like saying I will develop a comedy, or I'm going to seek, you know, this role in this thing, I never had that thought or experience. It just doesn't, it was not part of my nature to work that way. So I was feeling very, you know, well fed with the dramas I was getting. I do, you know, I am equal parts overly self-serious as a person as I am silly. But I do know that because I am socially uncomfortable, that it's the former that plays its lead role if I'm in public. And I don't mean public in front of a camera or some kind of public event. I mean in a restaurant. I mean interpersonally with new people. I favor a wall of words or a certain kind of intense subject, or I lock up. And so I don't think that I was very well advertising myself as somebody that was going to make you giggle. And so I didn't get a lot of offers over the years. I did, a couple of movies. I did a movie with Robert De Niro that was a comedy, Angels, and I did Woody Allen's movie, Sweet and Lowdown.
All right.
And yeah. Time stuff, but I just didn't pursue it, and I wasn't pursued for it.
I'm an avid carpenter and a woodworker, and that was my business before I got into show business, if I am in fact in show business. But what I did to earn a living for my entire adult life before comedy was carpentry. So I didn't go to college. I just graduated North Howard High, bought a pickup truck, and worked as a full-time carpenter. So when you said you liked woodworking and you were in the garage and you liked working around your tools, I made a note to circle back to that. So can we talk about that?
I'd love to.
What do you like doing, and how long you been doing it? Well, it's been a while since you were in the garage back in 80 or 81 when the phone rang for Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Is that something you still do? And do you do projects around the house, or you do like Nick Offerman style, I'm going to make a kayak in the garage and sell it to David Letterman for $26,000? Is it that? Or?
I talked to Nick about that. We were talking about tools. I like to customize compartments, and I like to make furniture. I had a beautiful lathe for a number of years and loved to do a lot of turning stuff, and which I would include in the furniture. But that lathe burned down in a house fire or in a fire many years ago in Malibu, where my house went down, and I haven't had a lathe since then. But it's mostly Mr. Fix-It stuff or furniture or compartments, because I'm always trying to reimagine spaces and how to fit certain things, and I like things to fit perfectly. So I'll get the things I have first and then make a piece of custom cabinetry to fit it.
So you would do, like, I built, Chris, I don't know if you can find it, but I built my daughter a bed a couple of years ago, like platforms, stairs, drawers built in, carpeted the top, you know, mattress. I built my son a loft in the same house, like ladder, loft, you know, that kind of stuff. I used to build a lot of entertainment units, and I did a lot of cabinetry. I did a lot of rough stuff, too. It sounds to me like you're a little more woodworker than you are carpenter, or not carpenter, but I mean fix it guy. Like, you're not spreading stucco on the outside of a building.
No, I am. In fact, there was a wall that shouldn't have been here all the years that I've lived here. I've lived here about 10 years. And so right as COVID was starting and as we were trying to jump ourselves into a lane to respond on offering up to the local government to get involved, Corps, my immediate COVID quarantine therapy was to punch an 8-foot wide hole in the wall and build an arch and stucco it up. And now I have an arch.
Really? I've done some arches. This is crazy. I love that you're into this stuff. I've been saying for a long time, I'm so into it. And I've always been into it. And I've always done my houses. And I've always done other people's stuff. And I believe there's a kind of therapy to it. I think there's a process to it. I think there's also, we have a picture of my daughter's bed there, Chris Loxamana. Yeah, there's drawers and cabinets and the mattress up top and the stairs built into the side. And it's nothing... it's nothing spectacular, but it's just a good example of being able to just build something in the garage. I just knocked it out.
That's a good project. You're clearly skilled. I'm a little bit, I'm going to guess because I'm just looking at a picture, but I'm a little more the guy who it's like baking without the measuring. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, because I'll just figure out a way to fix it if I do something wrong. I don't like it. Is such therapy. I forget to smoke. You'll maybe note the cigarette smoke coming through the frame. I can be out there 5 hours and not smoke a cigarette and not know that I haven't smoked a cigarette. Because
right.
It is such.
Yeah. No. I see. I started to really drill down on this. Pardon the pun. Because I was thinking to myself, we have a strange relationship with danger now. We're not processing it properly. And I started to think about all the guys I know who work with tools, and they all seem to be properly calibrated. So you brought up a lathe. When you fire up a lathe, or you fire up a router, or you fire up a bandsaw and many other tools, you have to have a proper sort of respect and then a proper relationship with what you're doing. Otherwise, you're going to get fucked up fast. On the other hand, you still need to do it. It's just, I'm going to do this and I'm going to approach it in a certain way and I'll use my experience and I'll choose the right tool. And then you get to work around, you know, carbide tip blades and lathes and chop saws and table saws and do it in a way that's safe. So you're constantly sort of calibrated with your relationship to safety. And that kind of focus, I think, helps when pandemics break out or shit goes down. But it also is—it's also kind of a meditation dealing with that spinning blade.
It is. I mean, there's a natural born respect you got to have for it. I remember in wood shop in junior high school, coming real close to a mishap with a bandsaw, because bandsaw is a pretty volatile beast itself. Where I am not, you made me think of this because you asked about, you know, more fix it than carpentry. When I say I do carpentry, one of the things I had just signed up for a technical school before COVID hit to learn electronics because I've never been, you know, I don't know AC from DC and voltage, it's all. And I, in doing this arch, I electrocuted myself twice. So while I have a good mission focus, with the tools themselves, I don't always think about what's inside that organism called a wall.
Yeah, it's easy to get your saws all out, bayonet saw, whatever, drop it in between some stud bay and not know that there's conduit running through that bay. And it'll tell you because you'll start fighting it a little like, hey, this thing's stuck up on something. And you go, fuck it, I got to press harder. And that's when you cut the wires, right?
You see some sparks, and by the time you see the sparks, you've already lost your footing.
I was also reading about an article that you wrote. I think it was in the Hollywood Reporter, but it doesn't matter where. But it was talking about your dad and how you admire him because during this whole blacklisting thing that was going on in the 50s, in Hollywood, how your dad took a stand. He lost a bunch of work as an actor, all the work as an actor, had to find a job in directing. And then I was thinking to myself, you know, it's mirroring a lot of what's going on today. You turn on the news and this guy's got to step down for a tweet, or that guy's got to step down because he said the wrong thing. And there are a lot of people getting canceled, actors getting canceled. And I thought I should talk to Sean about this because I feel like he has a unique perspective on it, knowing what the old version of it was with his dad back in the day, McCarthyism and whatnot, and a new version or type of version of it that's kind of going on now where we're trying to get people removed from their ability to work. I want to do that. I want to take a quick break, and we'll come back with Sean Penn and talk about that right after this.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all-woke, no-joke culture.
I love these as-seen-on-TV products. I knew they were going to phase out the penny, but I didn't realize it had already taken a ton out of circulation and infused all that copper into socks, underwear, T-shirts, and work gloves. The ads always have some aged NFL player saying, I can use my hands again, thanks to Copper Fit Gloves. Or my knees don't ache, thanks to my copper-infused leggings. Or my wife had 5 orgasms last night, thanks to my Copper Fit condom.
Available now in all formats. Pick up a copy now at adamcarolla.com.
All right, back with Sean Penn. By the way, his organization, which is doing the Lord's work, CoreResponse.org is where you go. They're getting the tests out there for COVID-19. They've got sites across the United States. They've already done over 600,000 tests since March 30th, and they're looking for donations, volunteers, involvement. So please go to CoreResponse.org. So in this article where you're talking about your dad being blacklisted in the 50s as an actor, not being able to work, I feel like some of that is going on today for various reasons. Do you have any feelings or thoughts on that?
Sure. I think when one looks long, whether backward or forward, and forward, of course, you can only do that if you've looked backward. You know, the old idea of studying history, you don't know where you're going with that. But looking long on this, there is a cycle of what happens in terms of societal cannibalism, separate apart from leadership and governance, what we do to each other. And for me, the biggest concern is always the hypocrisy that I don't know a human being that, looking honestly, doesn't find hypocrisy in a day, much less in the last 10 years of their life, the last 20 years of their life, the last 30 years. And I'll call on the most controversial version of this because I've already taken some shit for things I've said. Look, the core of Me Too and Time's Up, any moron knows, is essential and real, and something we need to get more devoted to, the core of it. What we experience in terms of the people we talk about, because they're the known people, and you're talking about actors or actresses and whatever the thing is, comedians, musicians. The hypocrisy to me was when most of, and I will say not all, with some significant, you know, exceptions, most of the famous actresses that jumped onto that, and maybe with genuine concern, had said shit all about our tax dollars going to bomb Yemeni children. Shit all. For years. But now there was something to jump on in a pack and destroy people. Some of them deserve to be destroyed. You have no frigging business hurting a woman in this way. Nobody does. Or abusing power. But you also have no business be you a man, woman, child, black, white, whatever, in acting on it in a pack without looking back on your own actions in life and finding out how to balance and acknowledge those things. So what happens is that when we jump into a trend of attack, something that we are going to be supported in, and we know that, that part of it takes no courage at all. And therefore, there's a level of credibility that drains the core issue. There's a level of lack of credibility, I should say, that drains the core issue. I think we know when people are genuine. We saw Dr. Blasey Ford testify. I'm telling you, I've been what you call a professional observer of human behavior for a long time. And if that woman said one thing that wasn't true, curse me dead. There was something so significantly genuine about the way she communicated. I'll leave it to others what that means about this judge who clearly his politics are obscene to me. That said, was he 19? And what do we want to do? And who are we? And I think each person has a different right. And we make it up ourselves, but we've got to acknowledge our own hypocrisy in it, whether it had to do with the same trend or something else or something that's going to come tomorrow. But you don't need a McCarthy today. You need your neighbor. You need your friend, your colleague. And they get on Twitter or they get on whatever the other things are and can destroy anyone they like. And I'm not for it.
No. To me, it's us as human beings. It's sort of us at our ugliest. You know, we have these impulses that need to be tamped down. You know, everyone has a vanity and a pettiness, and people are lustful and people are jealous and people are envious. You know, we have a lot of built-in bad qualities. You know, all you have to do is raise kids and you know what human beings are like when they're 5 years old. They're pieces of shit. You know, they're selfish. They want everything. They want it now. The world revolves around them. And I get it. That's how we are. And then we must raise you out of that. And so those kinds of impulses, they live inside of all of us. We used to just do a better job of keeping them in check. It was sort of like how you would dress when you flew 50 years ago versus how people dress now on a Southwest flight. Like, we all get it. Everyone's more comfortable in flip-flops and sweatpants, but you have a certain way of carrying yourself, a dignity. And so you don't engage in that. And something has happened that these things that we used to have to tamp down in ourselves on an almost daily basis, somebody just pulled the ripcord on that shit, and people have lost their dignity and all those ugly parts that live in all of us. It's not like they don't exist or never existed. People just had decorum, dignity. They wouldn't speak that way about somebody else. They wouldn't call. I mean, you would never call someone a racist who wasn't a racist or, you know, involved with racist behavior. You would never call someone a misogynist or any of the things that we're so willing to call each other at the drop of a hat. We used to do a much better job of keeping all that in check. And now it's just a fucking race to the bottom.
Well, you know, it started some time ago. I mean, I'll be 60 next month, but people older than me will tell me this started before I was around. And we grow up with the illusions or the delusions of that we were conditioned to believe in, even as it applies to what a patriot is. I'm a patriot because I love this country, despite that it bathes in its own kind of obscene exceptionalism as a culture. We look at COVID. You look at that line north of us, and you can have 1 foot in the United States and 1 foot in Canada. Canada's curve is flat. And we're on these spikes. It's simple why. Nobody needs to be a scientist to know why. It's basic respect for your society, for yourself as an individual, but also for other people, for your friends, for your neighbors, for your country. And when there's such clear science, and yeah, some people maybe live, you know, they're never going to get it being outside, being 10 feet away from somebody, and somebody else might. But everybody has an opportunity to wear the stars and stripes of a mask in basic simple situations as a sign of solidarity, if nothing else. And the charisma, the arrogance is charisma in this country, period, plain and simple. And I think that that's what plays into this social media stuff, because when arrogance is celebrated, like it is so much more and more every day here, you will jump on a trend of that is arrogant and lose track of what that transmission is. And I go back to Me Too and Time's Up and the great people that are involved with that stuff, with men and women, mostly women, most importantly, women of color. Most importantly, women of color who are not famous. And I think that because of arrogance, it's kind of what is that term they say? One drug that leads to another.
Gateway.
Yes, arrogance is a gateway drug to every mischosen position. And heightened sense of one's own importance in this stuff. And I can be guilty of this too. In fact, I have been a lot. But I don't know anybody who isn't. And that's where the hypocrisy part of it comes in. And that's why when you take somebody's entire legacy, livelihood away, when you start, you know, they're talking about, you know, people are taking a look back at movies now. You know, well, I say to people, look at the art on your walls. What was the history of that painter? What did they do?
Yeah.
Well, it's a bottomless.
Yeah, Spicoli was laughing, saying those guys are fags. I mean, I don't know. Do we have to go back and edit that out? I don't know. I mean, eventually we'll get to everything.
These are snapshots of a particular time. Look, your documentary. Here's a guy who, you know, liked being called uppity because it got him more fired up. He had an ownership of himself. He paid an unfair price every day of his life, probably still today.
Oh, he liked the whole part uppity. He liked the N-word after uppity. It wasn't just the uppity part.
Yeah, and yet people say they're sensitive to it, and they're the ones that have been plagued with it. You got to listen to that too. And so, how do we evolve? How do we, you know, this whole the whole issues with police departments now? You know, alongside racial brutality that has plagued the country since we first, you know, stole people from their homeland and brought them here. And then despite the fact that they, as much as anyone, they, meaning Black America, built the America that we know, and half, if not more, of the things we most love and get out of value of society. And brutality is not racial alone. And police departments, like the priesthood, and I've talked about this before, these can draw the best and the worst. And people who want to be involved, engaged in a life of brutality, that's a good job. Being a priest, for those who are pedophiles and all of that, it's a good job. You got trust and authority. Same thing for police officers. But you also have extraordinary people working in these jobs. And I call both of them jobs because I'm a pretty secular thinking guy. But I do have a lot of respect for the good intent of a lot of people that work in religion.
Yeah, I agree. I'm an atheist, but I'm happy that there's a thing called religion. It kind of drives me nuts when people do that, all this religion or that. It's bad. It's like, it's bad, it's good, everything's bad, everything's good. You know, we need to get back to nuance. There's good cops, there's bad cops, there's good priests, there's bad priests. It's just that notion that priests are bad or cops are bad is false. It's just like parents or neighbors or anyone who's ever born.
And doesn't mean that we don't recognize when a thing like that has to be radically reformed. It's just a question of really recognizing that with the principal dynamic where it plays out, and partly because of the impunity with which policemen can function in marginalized areas, we also have to recognize a brutality that, racist or not, we share. And we have to find a way, you know, to train police officers to recruit police officers and to implement what police officers do that is not a breeding ground for the brutal. I was in LA County jail when I was in my 20s, and some of those guards were nothing but brutal. And I'm not a black guy. I'm just a, you know, white guy in America. But they were brutal and piggish. And that had nothing to do with the job, LA right. County.
Yeah, you're in for 33 days, I think I recall reading your wiki page today, which is not a short it's not a short period of time to be in prison or jail.
Yeah, it was 34 technically, because it was a midnight in and a midnight out. But but yeah, you can do it an hour at a time, and it's boring. The last thing in the world you need is somebody who's a failed football player, you know, who got a job on the LA County Sheriff's Department. Meanwhile, I've got great friends on the LA County Sheriff Department who are service-oriented people who give a damn about people more than they think about drawing their weapon. And God knows, you can't immediately associate a police officer with a murderer, but you goddamn well can recognize when a police officer commits murder, as in the George Floyd case. There's no such thing. All of this nonsense that may come up in trial, there's no such thing as it not being premeditated. Who among us can be with a knee on a neck for that long and not at decide, I'm going to go ahead and kill this guy with my hands in my pockets?
You know, the only good news about that in this country is there's nobody who thinks that guy's not a criminal, that cop, and a murderer. There's nobody I've met or spoken to or heard speak on the radio or on TV. Everyone agrees that guy's 100% wrong and needs to be brought to justice, which is good. It's bad that he did that, but it's good as a nation we agree who that guy, who that cop is, and what should happen to him.
Yeah, but I don't agree with you. I think this is similar to, you know, it would not be popular. It is not trending. It is not Me Too to say this guy's not a killer.
No.
I'll wait till November to find out if people think that this guy, you know, if some people don't think he's a murderer. We don't know what's going to happen. And this is not a Republican-Democrat conversation. This is a conversation about somebody who, a leader who clearly inspires the brutality, inspires the lesser than mentality, and harvests it into something that is a perfect storm of destructiveness. And yet you look at what's happening with these movements right now, with citizenry right now, involvement right now, and I think he's going to lose. But that's not because I think this is a country full of people who wouldn't protect that police officer in a court of law. I think that still remains to be seen.
Well, I hope he's found guilty, and I'm assuming he will. But because we're pressed for time here, I got two more quick questions for you. Is it easier to be you at 59 and 7/8 than it was being you at 24? A lot of guys I know have mellowed out over the years. I've kind of noticed that the guys get more mellow and the women tend to get crazier as we get older. But it would be tough to be Sean Penn at 23, but figure at 59, more comfortable, less testosterone. Like, what Is it just more comfortable to be Sean Penn now than it was when you were 25?
I'll start this way, and I'm sure you agree. It would be a sign of insanity if a woman of my age did not seem to us more crazy than once than she a woman might have been at a younger age, were that woman to have spent time with either of us at 24.
Right.
I say that with humor, and I say it seriously, and it's not just about women. It's about everything that, and that's what happens, is I think that the more you come to acknowledge who you are, what you've been, where you've been, what you've done to compromise your life, people around you, it actually is more relaxing than being in the throes of destruction. And we are, most of us, most men certainly are very self-destructive. And in some way, I think it's a tribute to self-loathing. And I don't know all where it comes from. I was a guy who had a very lucky childhood, very loving parents, grew up in this beautiful place, and created my own demon doors. Where I am today is really excited all of a sudden about where young people can take the country, because when my son went to school, it was unheard of that anybody got in a fist fight. Now, I didn't grow up in tough neighborhoods, but everybody my age got in 20 a school year. And it wasn't happening the same way. Of course, in some areas it does, where people have to, you know, posture a certain kind of toughness to survive. But more and more, the way that people, you know, with all the mean girl mentality and all of this tough stuff and the bullying online and everything else, between the cracks, I've noticed watching my kids grow up that there's been an evolution in the way that people treat each other, young people. And now they're not 12 and 13 anymore. Now they're 19, 20, 25. Maybe I'll take youth up to 30 right now.
Right.
Because it's twice as young as I am. And I'm feeling like that this world's got a shot in a way I haven't felt. But I also feel like I did enough things in my life with good intention that I can put up my feet and watch it happen. So I'm much more comfortable in my life today than I ever was before, just being able to relax.
Last question. Favorite tool? Do you have a favorite woodworking tool? I have many.
That's a good question. I'm going to say, planer.
You got,
but as, yeah. Sometimes measure, so I have to replane to get it to fit.
You have a power planer, like a hand for doing like a planing a door, something like that.
Or the edge of a plank, whatever. Because I do a lot of dowel butt work, like making tabletops and all of that.
Oh, you do
stuff.
A lot of doweling. Do you use a biscuit joiner or plate joiner?
No, I use the pipe clamps.
You dowel them. What I mean is, like, do you have a biscuit joiner or plate joiner? Oh, this may change your life.
I have the grip that's got the drill, the hole for the drill to go. Am I flipping you off? Sorry.
No. You don't want to dowel. You don't want to dowel. Use a biscuit. Chris, go find a plate joiner or biscuit joiner.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, but really on the heavy lifting stuff?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, maybe go with the dowel and use your bar clamp on there. But I used to do a lot of doweling for doing like face frames for cabinetry and stuff like that. And at some point, somebody invented that biscuit joiner, that plate joiner, it's called. And it just kind of changed my world. But yeah, if you're going to do a full tabletop, I like the doweler because it's just a jig that you just use with you clamp it on and then just use your drill with it. But I like a random orbital sander. When I started out all we had was belt sanders and vibrating sanders. And then somebody invented the random orbital sander with the hook and loop Velcro, a sandpaper. That was a game changer for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are good fun, but you're going to make Animal Lumber some money tomorrow. Cause I'm going to go down our tools.
Get a plate joiner. Well, so you're out on Point Doom. All right. One of these days I'll come by and we'll do a little woodworking.
Would love it. Would love it.
I would love it too. Sean, thanks for being generous with your time. The organization, one more time, is called CORE, C-O-R-E, Community Organized Relief Effort. And you can find them at coreresponse.org. Sean, I hope we can do this again soon.
Me too. Thanks very much. Pleasure.
Thank you. My pleasure. All right. The great Sean Penn, everybody. Last but not least, we got J.B. Weld. Well, we were just talking about woodworking. Why not get out your J.B. Weld? DIY projects to get through? Yeah, sure. Why not? Want to save some money, not have the repairman have to come by the house? Big or small repairs, home or garage, ordinary household glue. Well, it's got the word ordinary in it. You need J.B. Weld. It's a better choice. We're proud to have J.B. Weld as a sponsor. I know the owner. I went by the booth at SEMA, hung out with these guys. The product is great. I used J.B. Weld yesterday. I used the super glue yesterday. Not the two-part epoxy, but just a one-part fast-drying stuff. Little thing on my phone busted off, and I fixed it right up. J.B. Weld, put it in your toolbox, kitchen drawers, crash room, wood or metal, plastic, whatever, and glue it all. Don't glue it. J.B. Weld. It's available at jbweld.com, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, O'Reilly, Walmart, and everywhere. J.B. Weld. All right, go to adamcarolla.com and see where we're doing live shows. And go to Amazon and get I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's going to ship soon. They've changed the date, so thank you. And enjoy that book. Write a review. Go to our YouTube page and check out some of my stand-up as well. And until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Bald and Gina and Sean Penn saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on the Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And please pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.
And before we get out of here, one more thanks to Geico. Do you own? Do you rent? What do you do? Do you want a bundle? Well, you own or you rent, or you got to have insurance. You got to have auto insurance. Bundle it. Make it easy. Save money. Let's get it under one roof at Geico. At geico.com, get a quote. See just how much you could be saving on your homeowners and your rental insurance when you bundle. That's Geico, geico.com.